Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. On Wednesday, the right-wing political commentator Charlie Kirk was shot and killed while speaking at a university in Utah. There is still so much you and I do not know about this story, and I encourage you to follow NPR's coverage for the most accurate reporting. But here's something I do know. America is divided on how to respond to this moment. I've seen some people on the right calling for revenge. I've seen some people on the left indifferent or even cheering that this right-wing pundit who frequently spouted bigoted views was killed. I've also seen people of all political backgrounds fearing for what the shooting and the reaction to it mean for this country's future. And that's what I want to get into here. The polarizing response to the shooting of Charlie Kirk and what Kirk's own statements on gun violence might tell us about what happens next. To do that, I'm joined by Abhinay Clayton. She's a gun violence reporter for The Guardian. Hi, Abhinay.
Hi, Brittany.
Okay, so I know you and I have both been glued to the coverage of this moment. I imagine like so many people listening to our conversation right now. From what you've seen and heard, how would you describe the reaction to this moment?
Well, the reaction has been one of the least surprising things I've seen. It reminded me of the UnitedHealthcare CEO shooting.
Yes.
In terms of divisiveness. But you also have this added layer of this gigantic catalog of these statements this man was making. So it was no surprise that people on the left were quickly bringing up his comments about, as you mentioned, gun violence, about women, about immigrants, about trans folks. It's no surprise that all of that came up. And it's also not surprising that people on the right, especially the far right, were calling for revenge, were immediately blaming leftists and treating him like a martyr.
I wonder, what do you think people are missing in the coverage of this moment?
I think people are missing the fact that a bunch of college students and folks who attended literally saw someone die right in front of them. You know what I'm saying? The devastation.
That's traumatizing.
It's so traumatizing. And there was a stat that came out maybe earlier this year or last year that described how many people in the U.S. have been at the scene of a shooting, how many people have witnessed gun violence and how wide that scope is.
Yeah, my editor is passing me that study and it estimates that one in 15 Americans has witnessed a mass shooting.
Yeah. And I remember like Second Amendment fundamentalists kind of shouting down people who were talking about that stat to say like, oh, this is just them fear mongering. This is just these people trying to make it seem like gun violence is worse than it is. And like, we're all being exposed. And it's like, well, we have 3,000 more people who just were, you know what I'm saying? So I think that the trauma and the wide scope of gun violence exposure is something that I don't know if we're ever going to get to because this is such a loud and shouty conversation.
Yep.
I also think people are missing out on the idea that two things can be true at the same time. You know what I'm saying? Like people can be horrified by what happened and also talk about the fact that he said very targeted and inflammatory things. I don't think that calling someone out for the things that they've put out into the world necessarily means that you don't have any compassion or any feeling for what happened. It's just the way people in the U.S. are operating now. We have to hold so many truths at one time. And I don't think that this is a circumstance where that's unfortunately going to be possible.
I mean, you know, given his close alignment with President Trump and you know, the outspoken conservative punditry that he's being remembered for, you know, there are politicians and people in the public saying this assassination was politically motivated, even though as of this recording, we don't necessarily know the causes yet. That is how a lot of this is being metabolized by not just everyday people, but also some public figures. And, you know, Kirk was known for his at times extreme right-wing views. He had made many people angry by saying that passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a mistake, or that the Bible passage that calls for stoning gay people is, quote, God's perfect law when it comes to sexual matters. Again, at the time of this taping, we do not know the motives of the shooter, but again, many are already seeing this as political violence and are worried about what this moment may signal. From your experience, Abhinay, does political violence beget more political violence? I mean, you know, last year we saw two assassination attempts on President Trump. This year, the assassination of one Democratic Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband, and the attempted assassination of another. I mean, not to mention other instances over the past few years, like the Democratic Pennsylvania governor's residence firebombed. I mean, you could even lump in January 6th, 2021. I don't know, like, can we call this assassination an isolated event, or is there a pattern to be concerned about?
That's a hard question. And it's also like, when have people on Twitter ever waited for facts to come out before calling something something?
Like, even aside from people on Twitter, like, there are members of the House right now that are pulling back from outdoor events. There have been, there have been threats of violence against five different HBCU campuses at the time of our conversation.
Totally. And I heard that Ben Shapiro canceled an event he was supposed to do that same day. I feel you, you know.
It's not just, you know, everyday people who are kind of making these connections, but also public figures kind of moving in a certain way as well, and institutions moving in a certain way.
I think if we're talking patterns, then there's a gun violence pattern. You feel me? I think it's too early to say if there's a particular pattern when it comes to political violence, because we just don't know who did this, what their reason is, what their background is.
So we can't even say what pattern it might fit into because we don't have enough information yet.
No, besides the pattern of like people being shot, of people deciding to take out whatever grievance, conflict, issue they have with a gun, that follows a very like long and storied pattern in the U.S., but devoid of any other specific information about the perpetrator, we just don't have enough information to say like, oh, this is in line with people who become, you know, radicalized on Telegram and then decide to get their firearms from this place and who look up to this particular shooter. Like, we just don't have the answers for all of that.
I'm also thinking about like the way I've seen some of the reactions play out online. You know, for example, a massively popular right-wing meme account posted on X immediately following Kirk's shooting in all caps, quote, "This is war." And that was in response to a montage of TikToks of different users appearing to celebrate Kirk being shot. In one video, a woman said, "I'm not saying he deserved it, but God's timing is always right." Can promoting politically motivated violence online or even joking about it fuel real world political violence?
I think we have to be careful with like drawing those sort of conclusions, like it's fueled by this, because there are plenty of people who are exposed to this kind of rhetoric who will never go on to like shoot someone, you know, or will never go on to put a pipe bomb somewhere. Like, it's a very specific set of circumstances and a very particular kind of person who is exposed to this kind of stuff and then takes it those steps further. So I'm always like a little cautious when talking about things being like fueled or catalyzed by, but what it does do that can have that sort of real world effect is that it normalizes it, right? It makes it seem like, okay, well, this is just how we react when someone who has bigoted or very bombastic views is killed. The sort of like new playbook we create for ourselves is dangerous in so many other ways, right? It being seen as like, well, this kind of happens is dangerous, right? It colors our reactions to things. It colors the way we interact with one another. I talked to somebody who was formerly at DHS who was studying this kind of stuff. He said that as people put out their jokes and put out their memes, it can lead to this idea that certain folks are like existential threats, right? People aren't just like annoying, aren't just disagreeable, but they threaten your being.
Another thing I'm thinking about is like,
don't know. I wonder if this moment could supercharge, more people into thinking that they need to arm themselves too. Like Kirk himself had long talked about the need to protect oneself from violence. In October 2023, he said, "Here is the brutal and honest truth of the world we live in.
Here is a brutal but honest truth of the world we live in. Evil is everywhere. More so than any other time that I've been alive. Evil in our streets, evil in our schools, evil in our government, evil domestically, evil foreign. The callous but direct truth is this. You need to be armed. You need to be prepared to defend yourself and your family."
How do people move toward that kind of reasoning?
Well, that's been going on for a while. At the beginning of the pandemic, there was a serious increase in gun buying. And it wasn't among the Charlie Kirks of the world. It was among people who look like you and me, right? Mm. Black folks, queer folks being like, oh no, I have got to get a gun because these white boys are crazy and they're already prepared. Then you see January 6th and people are like, oh, absolutely not.
So wait, more people of marginalized identities are buying guns? And reporters are hearing from them that it's about wanting to protect themselves from bigots.
Yes, absolutely. And it's still ongoing.
Still ongoing.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, right? You see people saying like, oh, no, that can't be me. You know what I'm saying? Like, if these white boys got guns, then I will too. That has been...
That's the mentality.
And it's an increasing sentiment.
Huh. So I have to point out too, though, that... that President Trump responded to Kirk's death by saying, quote, "For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today," end quote. But Trump himself has used demonizing and at times violent language when talking about his own political opponents.
People will often say that one party or the other is the party of like death and destruction, which I feel like is a really flat way to talk about targeted violence and gun violence and shootings, because sometimes the people who are doing it really don't fall neatly into one camp or the other. But again, that doesn't stop us from like pushing forward these narratives, right? It's just kind of continuing this, the divisiveness that is already so salient in our culture today. And the fellow that I mentioned who was formerly at DHS, he literally said, you know, if people keep talking like this, we're going to end up in this quote really blew my mind, in a tit for tat death spiral he said is the only result of continuing inflammatory language.
Okay. So that is a vibe that we're seeing kind of coursing through some of the discourse and reactions on the right in this moment. But looking to the left, Charlie Kirk was undeniably a polarizing figure for his, at times, extreme conservative views. He said some extremely bigoted things. Because of that, I have seen and heard some folks who are saying, you know, something like, you know, this type of violence shouldn't happen, but I'm not mad that it did happen to this person, meaning Charlie Kirk. What would you say to someone who takes that kind of stance in this politically charged moment?
I think that is, that's a tough one. You know what I mean? Because it's like, even that comes with its own dangers. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm a Black woman. To me, the things he was saying was like, no, this just does not work for me. This is racist. This is trifling. And I also think there's a little bit of pressure from other folks on the left to see Democratic lawmakers say, like, this person was horrible. This is bad, yes, but also look at what he said. I think that's what people want, but that's not super advisable if we're trying to create an environment of like peace, safety, and justice for everyone.
Coming up?
Condemn and grieve with the nation. That's what you do to stop this sort of violence from being normalized. And that is the furthest thing from some of these folks' minds.
Something else that I also want to be sure to mention is that Kirk's death was not the only instance of gun violence on Wednesday. At a school in Colorado, two students were critically injured in a school shooting. And a third student, the suspected shooter, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And Abinay, just 2 weeks ago, there was a school shooting in Minneapolis where 21 people were injured and two children died. This shooting of Charlie Kirk was a very public shooting, but is it emblematic of the gun violence in people's everyday lives? Like, how does this shooting sit alongside the day-to-day reality of gun violence in America?
You know, that is that's an excellent question and also a kind of complicated one. There are high-profile shootings, and then there are lesser-known shootings. If we're talking high-profile shootings, then this is kind of in line with those, right? We don't know who the shooter is, what their motivations were. All we can do is assume and speculate. In a lot of people's minds, this was a grievance-based, targeted, political act of violence, as so many of these high-profile mass shootings are, right? Whether it's a school shooting, whether it's a shooting in a mall or a church, oftentimes you see people do this kind of stuff because they have something to say. And because of so many factors, they decide that a firearm being used in a very public or very sensitive place is the way to express those feelings. So if we're sticking just to that, then yeah, this does line up with it. But if we're talking about all the other ways that gun violence shows up, then no. Most gun deaths are suicides, which I feel it's incumbent to say because people don't realize. Yeah, people are surprised every time. And gun deaths that aren't the result of suicide are community violence deaths, right? Interpersonal beefs and conflicts that end in homicides. So what happened to Charlie Kirk does not account for most of the shootings that end up, you know, kind of not making it out of local news or things that people deal with on the local level that the FBI doesn't get involved in, that you're not going to see the president give an address about. Like, those sort of circumstances are not in line with what happened to Charlie Kirk.
I want to talk a little bit more about Charlie Kirk's own words about gun violence. He both really believed in gun ownership and denounced gun violence, but also thought that some deaths were worthwhile in order to keep, you know, gun ownership rights. In 2023, he said, quote, "We should have an honest and clear reductionist view of gun violence, but we should not have a utopian one."
You will never live in a society when you have an armed citizenry and you won't have a single gun death. That is nonsense. It's drivel. Wow. But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth to have a cost of, unfortunately, some gun deaths every single year so that we can have the Second Amendment to protect our other God-given rights. That is a prudent deal. It is rational.
This is a view, though, that is not unique to Charlie Kirk.
No.
Abinay, how do you think people arrive at this line of thinking that some deaths are necessary to protect gun ownership? If you think violence is wrong, but also some deaths are necessary, how is that being reconciled right now? Like, not just in Kirk's case, but also when thinking about the school shooting that happened right outside of Denver on the very same day.
Yeah. I often kind of see that line of thinking described as like, well, this is the price of our freedom, you know, in a lot of ways, right? For some people, it's cultural. Some people, your daddy, your grandpa was in the military. They taught you about firearms and how important it is to be armed to resist things like Nazism and to make sure you can keep your nation free and your kids and your family safe. Like, it is embedded in American culture. Guns equal freedom to a lot of people. I think people will separate what happened at the school from like gun ownership and from people who have this very singular view of guns as being a necessary part of keeping people free and safe. They'll say like, oh, well, this is someone who was quote unquote mentally ill. And this is someone who shouldn't have had a gun in the first place. Or this is someone who took advantage of soft targets, right? They'll make these sort of delineations between the use of guns and what they see as the need for them.
But, and also too, what I'm also kind of hearing is that sometimes people who are maybe say anti-gun control also have sometimes like very conflicting views that they share about, you know, what causes gun violence and who should be allowed to have access to them. I mean, I even think about like Charlie Kirk himself, even as much as he spent, you know, his life promoting guns to a certain degree and gun ownership, he's also hedged the use of them. Like at a different event in response to an audience member who asked,
where's the line? How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?
So, no, no, hold on. Stop. Hold on. Now I'm going to denounce that. I'm going to tell you why. Because you're playing into all their plans and they're trying to make you do this. That's okay. Just hear me out. What I'm saying is that we have a very fragile balance right now at our current time where we must exhaust every single peaceful mean possible.
It just feels like even within his own belief system, something that you're saying when you talk about Americans who are very pro Second Amendment, similarly to Charlie Kirk, kind of have some of these, I don't know, like it's almost like a patchwork quilt of different feelings about gun ownership in different contexts and different uses.
Yeah, I think what you said about like in different contexts and different uses is really the key, right? Like I think a lot of people may see themselves as like Second Amendment fundamentalists, but there are bounds to that, you know, like every circumstance isn't the exact same.
Sure.
But there are a lot of factors that lead people to shoot each other. And I don't think that the totality of what gun violence looks like is ever really considered by people up and down the political spectrum. You feel me? Like this isn't just a conservative issue. I think a lot of people speak in ignorant ways about guns and gun violence. And another thing, I've talked to experts on like targeted and political violence. They say the most important thing that leaders in this moment can do is condemn. Condemn and grieve with the nation. That's what you do to stop this sort of violence from being normalized. And that is the furthest thing from some of these folks' minds. And I think that as Americans, we're not outraged enough by that, by the reaction being calling for revenge, saying like, okay, we need to like get back at the Democrats. We need to, you know, deport people who speak ill of Charlie Kirk. There's no one saying to them like, hey, that's only going to make things worse.
Well, Abhinay, thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciated having your expertise on this. And I couldn't think of a better person to talk to than you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, this was an interesting conversation. We'll see what happens, girl.
We will see what happens. That was Abhinay Clayton, a gun violence reporter for The Guardian. So, quick vibe shift here at the end, but last week I promised to reveal on this episode my song of the summer this year, and I always keep my promises. So, I can say now that it's Freaky, Just My Type by Sherelle and George Riley. But I saw a lot of other great songs from everyone who commented too. Boy Crazy by Kesha, Leave Me Alone by Renee Rapp, Lemon Drop by Atiz. I haven't heard all these songs, but I cannot wait to add them to my playlist. And to everybody else, I love hearing what y'all connect with in these episodes. So wherever you're listening, drop a comment or review, and you just might hear me shout you out right here. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Liam McBain.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patak.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.